From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour was made in October of 2006. A snow and ice storm ravaged the area. Now, Rochester is all too familiar with that. But this one struck from Batavia, essentially west to Buffalo. 90% of the trees, especially in the Buffalo area, were damaged. It was a devastating loss to green space. So what to do? Well, you might be surprised to learn that in the past 8 years, Buffalo's had a resurgence in parks and green spaces. We're going to look at why and how with one of the people most responsible. Thomas Herrera Mishler is the CEO and president of the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy. Tomorrow night, Herrera Mishler will be the final speaker in the Reshaping Rochester series hosted by the Community Design Center of Rochester. We're going to talk to him in just a moment, but first, we're looking for your support. My colleague Jean Fisher is here. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Evan. It's good to be back with you again. And I want to take just a moment, first of all, to remind folks that we have a different phone number, a different way for you to participate and connect with this program, and that's 1-800-295-9994. And what I'm asking folks to do is just to think back over the last, 5 months of this program. Evan came aboard in January of this year, and the conversation has really kind of opened up and taken new directions, and we've expanded the conversation into the Finger Lakes, and now we have participation from many, many more different areas, and the conversation has gotten broader because we're covering more regional topics. And that is all made possible by listeners who call that number, 1-800-295-9994, and make some kind of financial commitment to help make this program possible, help pay the bills, help pay Evan, help pay Dave behind the glass, help pay for the microphones and the equipment and the electricity and so forth. And we're not asking you to pay the whole thing. If you'd like to, you can, certainly. I won't stop you. But we have an interesting conversation coming up about parks and green space. And I like to think of public broadcasting and public media as sort of the park or the green space of the airwaves, where it's all of our responsibility to take care of it. There might be some tax dollars that go into it, as we get from local, state, regional, federal government. But it's really the people that provide the impetus to make sure that we have parks and green space and to make sure that we have public forums and great information and beautiful classical music and wonderful, inspiring music on public media. So if you could consider $5 a month, a pledge at the $60 level, or $10 a month, a pledge at the $125 level, or maybe a one-time gift of $15 or $25 or $30 or whatever, then you can call that number right now, 1-800-295-9994. Or you can make your gift online at weos.org or online at wxxi.org, or use the WXXI smartphone app. When you click on that, there's a donate button right there on the app, and it's so easy to do. And it just like that, you are supporting something wonderful. So thank you so much for your support of Connections.
And nice to see you, Jean. Thank you very much. All right, let's talk about some of those things. Jean is the master at connecting themes here. She really is. And let's talk about what's going on tomorrow night. Tuesday, tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Universalist Church of Rochester on Clinton Avenue, South Clinton. It's the final lecture in the Reshaping Rochester series, and Thomas Herrera Mishler is going to be here for that. He's the CEO and president of the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy on the phone with us now. Thomas, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. And I remember in 2006, that was back in my commercial television news days, and I did a live remote for the Weather Channel in Batavia. It felt like all of the trees were gone. It was just a remarkable weather event, and it really impacted the green space from a lot of our region west to Buffalo. Your first time was in Buffalo not too long after that. What do you remember seeing?
Well, I arrived just 1 year later, and it was in the fall, and most of the leaves had fallen off the trees, and I'm a tree guy. I'm looking up at all the trees in western New York, and every single one of them was significantly damaged. I was shocked. Trees have a natural form that they develop over time, and most of the trees I was looking at had lost that natural form.
So you obviously had a pretty big step, a pretty big piece of work to do right there, but we also know that Buffalo's reputation comes from the fact that the system of parks there was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, the world-renowned landscape architect. And how valuable and how significant was that in your mind coming into Western New York?
Well, I mean, in my world, I'm a landscape architect, and for the last couple decades, I've been focused on taking care of public landscapes and historic public landscapes in particular. And this is about as plummy a job as one could hope for in my world, being able to take care of the oldest park system in the country, designed by the father of American landscape architecture. It's pretty great. And I flew into Buffalo, and I'm driving around, and I kind of stumble on the parkways, and I was stunned at how beautiful these parkways are and the beautiful homes that line them, and I just really wasn't expecting to find such a beautiful, beautiful city.
And here in Rochester, you'll be speaking tomorrow night, again, 7 to 9 at the First Universalist Church on South Clinton Avenue as part of this Reshaping Rochester series. And, you know, green spaces is not necessarily one size fits all, but there are questions about the return on investment and whether it's the right investment and how you do it. What are some of the messages? What are some of the lessons that you can bring to Rochester?
Well, there's a lot of really great things that we've learned here in Buffalo. One is that the better you take care of your parks, the higher the value is of the real estate surrounding those parks. And we've seen a 76% increase in value, home values around Delaware Park since the Conservancy took over the parks in 2004. This is our 10-year anniversary. The other thing that we've really noticed, and I think anyone visiting from Rochester lately has noticed, that the whole visual character of the entire city has been transformed. Because the Olmsted Parks are everywhere, the parkways thread throughout almost every neighborhood, and they look fabulous. They really are just so well tended. There's no litter, no graffiti. The grass is kept properly, and plantings everywhere. It really has been quite a transformation, and so the whole city looks and feels better. Quality of life's improved dramatically, and all of this makes Buffalo a greater place to live. I don't know if you saw recently, in-migration for millennials was recently tracked, and they found that Buffalo had the highest rate of in-migration of any city in New York State. So we're doing some things right.
Well, and you've mentioned the fact that real estate value, you see a 76% increase in proximity to parks, but I've heard interviews where you've talked about there's an important distinction here. You can't just put green space. It has to be well-maintained. It has to be essentially nice space. I mean, I'm probably mangling it in some way, Thomas, but help me understand that part of the point.
Okay, so there is a caveat to this, and it is that we are blessed with landscapes that were designed by a master. They're masterpieces of landscape design. And but the real value that you derive from these landscapes comes from them being well maintained. The flips the opposite is also true. Poorly maintained landscapes, whether they're designed by a master or not, have a very negative impact on quality of life and property values. So they do have to be well maintained. Here in Buffalo, we started an experiment 10 years ago in public-private partnerships where the City of Buffalo and the Olmsted Parks Conservancy are partnering on the maintenance of the entire park system, the historic park system designed by Olmsted. And as far as we know, we're the only nonprofit in the country that manages the whole park system. And we're able to do so at a remarkably reduced cost for really sort of extraordinary results.
We're going to be talking about the cost in just a moment here, but when you talk about some of these spaces, park spaces or green spaces, that if they're not well maintained, they can have the opposite effect. They could have a negative impact on the properties around it. I don't know how much this pertains, but that draws my mind to the question that Rochester, and I'm sure many municipalities, have had with what to do with vacant houses, vacant lots, lots that have become eyesores. And sometimes there have been questions about, do you just knock it down and grow grass over it, create a little bit of green space, and hope that that improves the neighborhood feeling, the sentiment there, the safety, et cetera. Are we oversimplifying? Do you see that debate in Buffalo as well?
Sure. And when I was in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Green Program, which is perhaps the most ambitious urban greening program in the country, we had to develop an urban vacant land management strategy because there's just so much of it. And many post-industrial cities are finding themselves with an excess of vacant land, brownfields and vacant residential parcels. And what we found, and we proposed this to the city of Philadelphia, is that they manage the vacant land more intensively, and not only the vacant land, but all open space in a community. And they partnered with community development corporations to do this, to keep the investment or the price down. And we found that if you maintain all of your vacant and open space in a community to a not a sort of Olmsted Parks level, but to a general standard of keeping the grass ankle height or lower, picking up any litter that might blow in, removing graffiti, and planting a few trees, we found that the return on investment was pretty fantastic. In Philadelphia, they were spending about $12 million a year, and we did an economic impact study that showed that if they increased their investment to $23 million a year, that they would actually, instead of it being a net loss of revenues, they would gain $1.38 for every dollar they invested. And that comes from the improved real estate values, the new development that would take place when you manage all of your open space more aggressively. So it's spending money to make money. You're improving the quality of life, the visual character of your community, the real estate climate, the investment climate in your community. And they took it out for a spin in North Philadelphia and around the Norris Square neighborhood. And property values around the square went up 300%.
Wow.
Over 5 years. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of real estate sort of values were going up in Philadelphia in general anyway at that time. But this was really extreme. And it was a neighborhood that you would not have wanted to have invested in before, and now it's become a very desirable community with great diversity of income and race, living harmoniously together and enjoying this beautiful park.
We see the phones beginning to ring. You can join the conversation toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 263-9994. We're speaking this half hour to Thomas Herrera Mishler, who is the CEO and president of the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy. He's going to be in Rochester tomorrow delivering a lecture called Green Legacy. He's going to be the final speaker in the Reshaping Rochester series that's hosted by the Community Design Center of Rochester, and talking about his experience in communities around this country, but really around the world. And we're going to get to that as well in just a second. But first, let's grab our first caller. Keith, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how are you doing? Very interesting show. I agree with you. The cities that have parks should be maintained because all the city residents can use them, and even people from outside the area can use them. For example, we had the Lilac Festival the last 10 days, I think it was. And it, other than the incredibly crappy weather we had, it was hugely successful. But the vast majority of those people probably came from outside of the city limit to a beautiful park. So any more park development, if the city wants to add a new park, in order to make the whole thing successful, you have to add affordable middle-class housing to it, because the middle-class people will use the park. You can't make it for rich people like you see on Park Avenue or the areas surrounding New York or Central Park. You've got to have housing for middle-class people, or you just continue the same problems that you have now.
Let's pause there, Keith, and let's let Thomas jump in and respond to that. Go ahead, Thomas.
Sure. Well, I agree that when you're looking at a city that has a growing vacant land management issue, and you're starting to think about parks as part of the redevelopment strategy, I think you want to think about what makes that park a sustainable landscape. And by sustainable, I mean one that's going to be utilized and maintainable and where possible, bring in earned income. And I'm not one of those park purists that thinks that earned income is are dirty words. I think that they're a really, really important part of funding strategies for 21st century parks, as long as they're done in a way that doesn't detract from the enjoyment of nature and the purpose of the park itself. A good example that you might want to look at is the new Brooklyn Bridge Park in Brooklyn, New York, where they took old docks that had been abandoned and turned them into this amazing waterfront linear park. And in a couple of places, they decided to invite requests for proposals to build some new housing. And some of it, as you can imagine, in that market is very expensive, in that market, but they also have some more affordable housing included in the plan as well. And they figured out that this was the only way that they could build this brand new park in New York City and afford to sustain it, mostly because it costs $15 million a year to deal with maintenance of the piers that are out in such harsh weather conditions.
Our phones are lighting up here with a chance to talk to Thomas Herrera Mishler, who, again, is the CEO and president of the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy. Let's keep it going with the phones if we could. Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, with Olmsted being recognized, I think we need to realize that he's probably the best historian for that period in terms of slavery and what the Civil War was all about. So in addition to his landscape architecture, we need to recommend that he documented what was going on in the South better than any other person.
Thanks, Mike. Thomas, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, this we're talking about a pretty remarkable guy.
Yeah.
And not only did his book about his walks and talks in England sell like crazy, and I recently reread it and realized why he was such a good author. I mean, his books were very readable. But his walks and talks through the South before the Civil War, he was not a sort of a rabid abolitionist when he went down there. He was sent to the South by the then brand new New York Times as a correspondent. And as he firsthand walked and understood what was going on with slavery in the South, he became a convinced abolitionist, because he believed that this was a terrible economic system and injustice. And he documented it so well that his book was published in England as The Cotton Kingdom, and it was apparently so influential in Great Britain that it caused them not to come into the war on the side of the South, even though cotton was their number one import at the time. And can you imagine what could have happened if the most powerful army, navy in the world had come in on the side of the Confederacy? We probably would have had a very different outcome than we did.
So yeah,
that's one of the many things he did. Well, during the Civil War, he raised $1 million for an organization called the United States Sanitary Commission, because so many soldiers were dying not from their wounds but from illnesses, disease and illness. And this organization that he was then hired to run is the predecessor to the American Red Cross and all the good works that that's done.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Great points there. And by the way, if you're just joining us, Thomas Herrera Mishler is the CEO and president of the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy. He mentioned the Olmsted Standard, or kind of Olmsted Standard Parks. For people who are not familiar or haven't seen it, what do you mean by Olmsted Standard, Thomas?
Well, Frederick Law Olmsted was very influenced by what he saw in his native New England. He was born in Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, in 1822. And his father was really dedicated to going out and finding and enjoying the picturesque. And on weekends, the family would get into a horse-drawn carriage, and they would go out looking for beautiful, picturesque landscapes. And then when he was a young man of 28, he went to England on a walking tour with his brother and a friend, and he was profoundly impacted by the beautiful pastoral landscapes and the sort of capability brown naturalistic landscapes that were all the rage in England at the time. And he went to the first public park called in Birkenhead, England, and saw this park. It was a park by the people, for the people, and he said, how can it be that in the United States, this democracy, we don't have any parks for by the people, for the people, and here in the monarchy, they have one. So his landscapes were what we would call naturalistic. They weren't natural in and of themselves. They were designed to look like they were the results of thousands or hundreds of years of growth, but they were very intentional. And he was very careful to make sure that the landscapes functioned well. For example, he would create very good drainage systems for landscapes so that they wouldn't flood and be unusable for certain times of the year. He would create walkways that were flowing and gentle in the way that they moved through the landscape. He avoided angular landscapes for the most part. So he designed a neighborhood here in Buffalo called Parkside. It's right next to Delaware Park, and it's got all those curvilinear streets that are so common in subdivisions these days. Well, that was the very, very first subdivision he designed, and it was the first one that we know of in the country that was designed with this curvilinear roadway. So it's the model for what then became the standard subdivision model around the country.
Let's grab one more quick caller here. We've got Rich in Rochester. Thanks for calling Connections. Rich, go ahead.
Hi, this is a really interesting conversation. You know, I was thinking of, I do a lot of walking. I go into the parks like Ellison Park and stuff. There is a lot of diverse wildlife in like Ellison and Minden. It doesn't seem like we take too many senses and we also publicize it. Like there's certain species of turtles that you're not finding in a lot of places like in Ellison Park. There's times when turtles are egg-laying. You'll go down in a park and you'll literally see a turtle egg-laying. I think if we publicize things like that also, that would bring into focus the importance of these parks, not only for just, you know, not only for recreation, but also what it brings to the area. You see owls there, you see different trees there. You have old trees in these parks, and I think that should be brought out and talked about.
Thanks for the call. Rich, go ahead, Thomas.
Well, let's think about the value of park landscapes to the urban condition. So not only are they a recreational asset, but they also are an environmental asset by providing biodiversity and habitat. They help to manage stormwater. Each mature tree is estimated to be worth about $15,000 in stormwater management alone. There's, you know, just reducing our carbon footprint. They reduce the urban heat island effect. Parks have been shown to, if they are well maintained and programmed, to reduce juvenile delinquency by about 27%. So we did some math, and we figured out that it would save Erie County about $2 million a year if the parks and the Olmsted Park system was maintained at the level that we wanted to maintain it at, just through the decrease in juvenile delinquency and incarceration. And then, of course, there's the benefit of the to real estate values, quality of life, cultural tourism. I mean, the list goes on and on. So, yeah, parks are incredibly important from just a recreational perspective, but then you add in all of these other benefits. The other interesting study that's been done is the impact of having parks that are well-maintained, that are located near population centers, on the amount of activity that people, just physical activity in their lives. And there's they've tracked the health benefits of living near a park, and there's a 20% decrease in diabetes and diabetes-related illnesses, which then turns into some really serious money for our community.
Before we let you go, one more quick comment here. And again, we've had a great amount of listener feedback in this half hour here. A caller off the air wanted to call and make the comment. You had referred to looking at a structure in Brooklyn, and she said you can't compare downtown Rochester to Brooklyn. But I know part of your work is looking at what works in other places and seeing what can translate. So what would you say to that, Thomas?
Well, the one thing that they're doing at that park that can translate to any park system in America is that they're managing it organically. And here in Buffalo, we're striving to be the greenest park system in America, and they use no artificial, no chemicals on their landscape. For example, here in Buffalo, we use compost tea, which we were introduced to by the guy who's managing the landscape there in Brooklyn. So yeah, it's a completely different environment in New York City. Of course it is, but many, many lessons can be learned and applied here in Western New York, in Rochester, Buffalo, and well beyond.
Tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Universalist Church of Rochester on South Clinton Avenue. Tickets are still available for the lecture from Thomas Herrera Mishler. It's called Green Legacy. He's the final speaker in the Reshaping Rochester series that's hosted by the Community Design Center of Rochester. Again, tickets available either on the Community Design Center of Rochester's website or there at the door, 7 to 9 tomorrow night. We'll see you here, Thomas, and thanks for taking the time to share your insight with us on Connections this afternoon.
Boy, I can't wait. Looking forward to being in Rochester.
We appreciate that. That's Thomas Herrera Mishler. Short break, and then we're going to take a look at an investigation that you might have missed it last week. It looks at the way our lawmakers are spending campaign dollars, and are there some questionable spending habits? We're going to talk to one of the reporters who helped break the story. That's next here on Connections. Tuesday on the next Connections, the Wine Symposium comes to the Finger Lakes. From expert guided wine tastings to panel discussions, we'll preview the event. We'll also learn about a new program designed to put more Finger Lakes wines in local restaurants. And from the Democrat and Chronicle, David Riley joins us to explain what he found in the latest round of documents on the LDC investigation. His reporting focuses on the allegations surrounding County Executive Maggie Brooks' husband. That's Tuesday on Connections.
Is it possible that the future of American industrial design lies with a motorcycle?
The goal is to separate, again, the drive for profit from the act of designing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, engineering an American renaissance. Next time on Marketplace, we'll have that and the numbers from Wall Street as well. It's from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6:30.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon, and glad to have my colleague Gene Fisher back on this important Monday.
It is a very important Monday because we are right smack dab in the middle and hopefully near the end of our spring membership campaign. You know, I was listening to Thomas, and I just sort of felt like if he could have tacked our phone number onto the end of his comments, the radio drive would be over. We could just all pack it up and go home. But let me give you that number since he didn't have it. It's 1-800-295-9994. And I thought it was interesting that he talked about having parks by the people and for the people, because that's really what public media is. We are here for the community, and it is radio that is by the community. It's not controlled by advertising interests. It is controlled by the needs of the community. And he talked about the urban value of parks where, you know, they are recreational. They're environmental. They're great for kids when it comes to that the issue of juvenile delinquency. And parks are just wonderful for the quality of life. And you could apply almost every one of those to public media, whether it's, you know, children's programming like Sesame Street or Clifford the Big Red Dog on television, to the kind of civil discussion that we have here on Connections, to the issues that we tackle and try to make you aware of, like the environment or education. That is all sort of that green space of public media. And before I carry that metaphor way too far, let me remind you that you can make a pledge of support and help end this membership campaign early by going online either to WEOS.org or WXXI.org. Either of those websites will get your contribution routed to the right place. And as soon as we reach our goal of $160,000, we're going to stop. Even if I have to stop in the middle.
You just cut yourself off right mid-sentence.
I did. So 1-800-295-9994. And I promise not to cut Evan and Connections off anymore. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Gene. Always nice to talk to you. It's a Monday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson, and we are looking at an issue that really began last July. Governor Andrew Cuomo created the Moreland Commission with an eye on investigating public corruption. And for a number of months, Moreland seemed to be going about their work. But earlier this year, the commission was promptly disbanded. Now, reporters at City and State obtained some internal documents from the commission, and those documents shed some light on what was being investigated. It turns out state lawmakers have tens of thousands of dollars in questionable spending from their campaign accounts. Lawmakers are not supposed to use campaign contributions toward personal spending, but there are questions about whether that happened, from casinos to cigars to tanning and salons and more. State lawmakers appear to have billed some interesting items to campaign accounts. One of the reporters who uncovered these documents is John Lentz, the Albany bureau chief for city and state. John, thanks for joining us on Connections.
Thanks for having me on the show, Evan.
All right. Well, John, first of all, I should let our listeners know, if you want to read John and the team's work on this piece, I've posted on my Twitter feed. That's at Evan Dawson on Twitter. Let's backtrack a little bit and start with this. What exactly was the Moreland Commission created to do?
Well, they were created to investigate corruption in Albany, looking at state lawmakers. The governor at one point, they had brought that to say they could look at his office, look anywhere they wanted to. This was in the context of a lot of discussion about how there is a lot of corruption in Albany. Lawmakers did not pass a reform package he had, and so he set up this commission. In the end, when there was a weaker package passed, this commission was shut down.
Okay, so you talk about shutting it down here. There are questions about why exactly. Why do we know? What are all the public reasons we know for why Moreland was shut down?
I mean, I think the governor's been pretty open about the fact that he got what he wanted. He got some legislation passed that would increase some penalties, would increase some enforcement measures to try to clean up Albany, basically. But it was interesting that it was midstream. There was initially going to be a final report issued later this year. There were ongoing investigations, several investigations, including this one where we obtained some really interesting internal documents looking at how campaign dollars are spent by state lawmakers.
Are you allowed to tell us, or what can you tell us, about how you and the team of reporters obtained the internal documents from the Moreland Commission?
I can't tell you too much, but we were looking at this issue for a while. We did obtain and verify these internal documents. We did talk to multiple sources in the commission, and they told us this was one of their top investigations as it was nearing the close of the commission itself. This was something they were really pushing, and they flagged a few lawmakers that had particularly interesting expenditures out of about two dozen that were initially flagged.
We're talking to John Lentz, who is the Albany bureau chief for City and State. Their story is called Inside Moreland: Documents Reveal Details of Lawmakers' Campaign Spending. And you are painstaking and detailed in your writing to say that, first of all, let me go ahead and read part of what you, along with your colleagues, write there. Quote, the documents do not explicitly accuse any lawmaker of outright wrongdoing or allege any criminality. In an informational, lawyerly tone, they summarize the expenditures that caught the attention of the commission's investigators. End quote. So they're not saying such and such senator or assemblyman, et cetera, have broken the law. But certainly, when you read some of the details, it is clear that there are at least questions about how that money was spent. Is that fair, John?
That is fair to say. And it's interesting because the law in New York is pretty vague, pretty broad. And so you would have to do something like the Moreland Commission was doing to actually figure out if anyone was violating the law. You don't have to put a lot of detail when you report what you're actually spending your campaign money on. And so the investigators had flagged some interesting things. They had planned to subpoena campaign treasurers. We're not able to get to that point because the commission was shut down. But I think it was a few years ago, one spokesperson for the Board of Elections said, quote, unless you out and out stick it in your pocket and walk away, everything is legal. So it's really hard to actually tell on one level, and even if you do find out what money's spent on, it's easy for a lawmaker to say, oh, well, this was tied to my campaign in this way or that way, to come up with an excuse.
Sure, okay. So they're very adept at coming up with excuses about the way they spend some of these funds, but you provide some helpful details from the documents here, and some of the details are enough that I can't imagine very good excuses for how they would legally be spent. Let's take an example. State Senator Patrick Gallivan was found to have about $80,000 in unreported campaign credit card expenses, and those included hundreds of dollars spent on cigars, tanning, and at salons and casinos. Cigars, tanning, salons, casinos. John, are there questions about State Senator Patrick Gallivan and what that, how you spend that in a way that's legal and proper?
Yeah, I think that's a set of really serious questions. I mean, first of all, that it was $80,000 in unreported expenses.
Unreported.
You're allowed to spend money where you don't say what it's spent on if it's an amount under $50. You can add those up. These are unitemized expenditures. It's completely normal. If there were high amounts of those, it really caught the commission's attention. But in Gallivan's case, they'd concluded that some of this money had not even been reported. And then you go a step further, right? Things like casinos and cigars. Sometimes things like that have been explained as, well, this was part of a fundraiser. You know, there were cigars given away to attract people to come, maybe casinos, maybe they held an event there. Tanning beds and salons, I'm not really sure how to explain that.
Nor am I. And there's more. That's just part of it. State Senator Greg Ball, quote, laid out around $23,000 at retail stores, including Brooks Brothers Banana Republic and Amore Clothing. Can you spend $23,000 if you're a state senator on Banana Republic and its ilk if you're doing it in some way connected to proper use of campaign funds?
Well, in Ball's case, he was one of the few lawmakers that provided a detailed response to our questions. He said these clothing purchases, in some cases $500, $600 per expense, were used for campaign use, including campaign photos, television shoots. He also, for about half a year, had a gym membership, it looked like, had spent a lot of money on iTunes downloads. He said both of those were for campaign events or campaign staff. Again, it's hard to know. I mean, it could be completely legitimate, or it could be something, come up with after the fact.
That's where I think you've done a very professional job. Well, you've done a professional job top to bottom, John, but you have been, you and the team there at City and State have taken pains to make sure you point out the way the law works and the way the law can be vague. So you're allowing people to draw their own conclusions, I guess. Is that fair to say?
That's what we really tried to do, and we reached out to all the lawmakers we referred to. In some cases, if they gave us relevant information, we explained things a little better and left some things out if we weren't sure about it. So yeah, I do feel like it's a fair portrayal. Of course, some lawmakers are still pretty unhappy with us for this piece.
Well, and that comes with the territory. And again, State Senator Greg Ball told you that all of that money at the retail stores was for campaign events, et cetera, that the money for iTunes downloads, that he's filling up his iTunes with campaign funds, it's because they're going to use all of that music as part of the campaign. Okay, well, if you give him the benefit of the doubt, at least you have an answer on that. What about Senator Patrick Gallivan? What did you hear when it comes to tanning salons and issues like that with $80,000 racked up at different places, including tanning salons and more?
The senator did not give us any detailed response. He sent a statement over basically saying we follow the rules, we're reviewing everything, we try to be by the book. So there wasn't much detail there.
He gave you a vague, we're trying to follow the rules and that's all we're going to say.
Exactly.
Okay. In our area, well, Western New York, State Senator George Maziarz, in your words, quote, shelled out more than $140,000 in campaign funds over a six-year period without identifying what exactly he purchased, according to the investigation by the Moreland Commission. What did State Senator George Maziarz tell you about that?
Again, a very similar response, saying that not going into any detail about the specific items we asked about, but said, we follow the rules. We don't think anything's wrong here. And just to clarify one point, that $140,000, that is allowed under state law. You can rack up that amount in unitemized expenses. However, in his case, the total was so much larger than every other lawmaker, it really raised a red flag for commission investigators. I think the next closest total was $100,000. Over this same six-year period. He had other expenses that were only vaguely described. He also had some of those what were concluded to be unreported expenditures, which again would be more serious. You know, it's not just taking city and state's word for it, but the Moreland Commission itself, which had a lot of great commissioners, a lot of DAs across the state, they felt like this was a very important investigation and wanted to really dig to the bottom of it. Again, they were not able to.
Well, we're going to get back to that in just a moment here, but I can't help but keep going down the list of some of these items that you uncovered. For example, the commission flagged purchases ranging from car repairs, auto insurance, children's items, a payment to Doo-Doo, the self-proclaimed clown of clowns. The clown of clowns, was this for a campaign event?
Conceivably. Again, we didn't get any details on that. But it was one of the funnier ones that stood out.
Yes. Yes, it's funny. Except for you consider that it's hard to figure out a legitimate way that Doo-Doo, the clown of clowns, who does children's events, is doing campaign events. But again, you didn't get very far with figuring out more about that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
What about auto insurance, car repairs? Any explanation for how car repairs and auto insurance could be used by campaign accounts?
Well, I think some of that is allowed. You're allowed to have a car to drive you around as you're campaigning during election season. But there was one lawmaker that really stood out there, State Senator Ruben Diaz. He's from here in New York City. He, at one point, had five cars held under his campaign account, although at this point he only has one. It's hard to know why someone would need that many cars as a single candidate. But, again, we were unable to get through to his campaign. We tried as hard as we could, and I didn't get any answer from him.
Talking to John Lentz, who is the Albany Bureau Chief for City and State, they put together this investigation after obtaining documents internally from the Moreland Commission, the recently disbanded Moreland Commission that was set up to essentially investigate for public corruption. And the story is on cityandstateny.com. It's called Inside Moreland, Documents Reveal Details of Lawmakers' Campaign Spending. Now, when it comes to the criminal side of this, again, you pointed out that the documents do not explicitly accuse any lawmaker of outright wrongdoing, but a commissioner from Moreland did say earlier this month that the commission had unearthed potential criminality by, what, a dozen lawmakers? Tell me about that.
Right, 10 to 12 lawmakers. And even before the commission was shut down, sources told us that some of this information that we document in our story was turned over to the Albany County District Attorney. We don't know if anything's happening there. We didn't get a response from them. And some people have said that the Albany County DA is not aggressive in pursuing these kinds of investigations. One big part of this story is that when the Moreland Commission was shut down, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District, that's Preet Bharara, was very outspoken in his unhappiness that the commission shut down its work when it seemed to be turning up some interesting stuff. And so he took over all those files. It's entirely possible that he might continue looking at some of these things, potentially even leading to criminal charges. I mean, that'd be highly speculative on my part to say that, but it's a real possibility.
The U.S. Attorney Bharara has made it clear that that's at least possible down the line. And if you read what that U.S. Attorney has said, as John has said, there is considerable frustration that Moreland was shut down seemingly at the height of when they were turning over some at least interesting and real questionable stuff. Some of the stuff that you've reported on, perhaps some other things. And John, if people say, well, hey, that's not what Moreland was all about, that Moreland was designed to do other things, that maybe the governor's office would say, hey, Moreland was, it did its job, we don't need it anymore. You write that there is at least some evidence now, or at least you're being told, that this was part of it, right? Tell me about that.
Sure. I mean, it is something that we saw it as a really legitimate issue, and that it was obviously a major issue for the commission. It's interesting that this ethics package that was passed, right around the same time that the commission was shut down, people saw that as a deal that, look, we came to an agreement, we no longer need the commission. But there was very little that was done in that package that would address these specific things. They didn't increase disclosure requirements. They didn't institute any sort of auditing capability. They didn't really address how lawmakers can spend their campaign funds. They did put in place a new compliance unit that, may help the Board of Elections police this sort of thing, but with the law as it is and the wide-ranging inconsistency in, how these things are reported, I don't think you're going to see any real change on this kind of thing.
Well, exactly right. This is when you read the story and you read the comments from, for example, U.S. Attorney Barrera and some others, that is perhaps the most surprising part of this, is that Moreland was created. The commission starts finding, I think, two things that are interesting. Number one, the commission in their investigation is obviously detailing many of the ways that campaign spending happens with a look at why probably there should be some changes. I think I'm trying not to editorialize, but I think that it's pretty well accepted that there should be some changes, that there should be a little bit more sunlight into the process. And so Moreland starts putting together some pretty good evidence that there needs to be more sunlight and some changes, along with looking at individual lawmakers who might have either broken the law or at least there should be questions about it. And right at the height of that, it shut down. Those lawmakers are not apparently going to be investigated. And the ethics package really doesn't address the way campaign spending is carried out. So that's the summation I get. And we're not off base there, right, John Lentz?
I think that's fair to say.
Okay. Yeah. Has the governor's office offered a comment to you on the work that you and the team have done?
No, it's a bit unclear because the commission has been shut down. We reached out to a former spokesperson. We also did call the governor's office. But they are, at least on some level, independent from the Moreland Commission. They set it up. The governor said it would be an independent commission, that it would do its own work. So in one sense, we don't really know what the governor's office would have to say about this investigation. We really just provided context in terms of, you know, a timeline, how the governor set it up, how this thing, you know, came to a close. So we haven't gotten any specific comment from the governor about the way this played out.
Okay, and I'm going to read one more short passage here from the piece because it focuses a little bit more on State Senator George Maziarz, who is from out towards Buffalo, but really from our area. And again, we're not saying that Senator Maziarz has broken the law. We're saying that there at least were questions raised by what came up in Moreland. The quote, "The commission found that the Maziarz campaign doled out more than $125,000 at retailers such as Target and BJ's Wholesale Club, including $56,250 in expenditures that investigators concluded had not been reported. Another $10,000 from the senator's reelection funds went to specialty chocolatiers, a florist, and wineries and wine stores. The campaign committee also paid $7,850 worth of reading materials at Borders, Reader's Digest, and Barnes & Noble's." Okay, John, I get Borders, Reader's Digest, Barnes & Noble. Maybe you can tell me that there's something related to campaigns, research, etc. Target and BJ's, maybe you're buying things for campaign events. What are you doing at a florist and a wine store with campaign funds?
That's a good question. You know, conceivably, You're buying things for campaign events. I mean, I'm sure a lawmaker could come up with an explanation that would satisfy the Board of Elections. I mean, but you know, it like I've said before, it is questionable. It is interesting. We did not get specific explanations about those things, and people who donate campaign contributions also in the public filings, it's there's even less detail. So it is hard to tell where these monies are going and whether it is legitimate.
And the state senator's brother, Marvin, came up here as well. Even though the Board of Elections told you it's not illegal to pay family members for legitimate campaign services, it appears through your investigation that could have been what's happening as well?
Right, yes. And I believe the senator talked to another outlet and said that this was for campaign consulting purposes. But again, if this investigation had never been done by the Moreland Commission, all it says in the public filings is MEM Enterprises and it's for professional services. There's no way to tell that this is going to the senator's brother. There's no way to tell what it's spent on. And the overarching question, you know, on this case and in the whole investigation is, can some of this be masking spending that really isn't related to campaigns?
John, before we let you go, we appreciate your time and the work of City and State. For those who haven't seen what you and your colleagues do, tell us more about what City and State is.
Well, we are a New York political newspaper, a magazine, I should say, and website. We put out our print publication twice a month. We have a website. We have two really popular emails we send out twice a day, a roundup of the top news. You can sign up at our website or, send me an email, jlentz@cityandstateny.com.
Thanks for taking the time. Is this story essentially over with Moreland Commission disbanded? You've gotten the statements back. Some people are giving you rather general comments. Is the story over or is there more to do here?
I'd say pay attention to what Preet-Bharara does, the U.S. attorney down in Manhattan. That could very well continue this story. There may be other strands to pick up as well. But, I'd say stay tuned.
Thank you very much, John. John Lentz, Albany Bureau Chief with City and State, joining us talking about their investigation. Thank you very much for the time today. And that's we appreciate you listening as well. And by the way, I've got about 15 seconds where I can tell you before the music comes that the music comes from Ra Ra Riot. They are on Barsouk Records, and some of our listeners in Geneva who know the local connection, if you want to find Ra Ra Riot, they've got some Syracuse University and some Geneva, New York connections down there, and we love hearing about that from them. You can find the song Shadowcasting online as well. You can buy it on iTunes, and we appreciate their support of the program. We also appreciate you, not only your phone calls today and all of your interaction online, but also supporting this program and public radio. This is a pledge drive of the utmost importance for us. We'd love to get done early so we can get back to no interruptions at all, even though the interruptions are rare. If you want to do that, call 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or WXXI.org. Hope you're enjoying Connections with Evan Dawson, and if you are, just think about a small contribution to make sure we can keep doing this for you. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Dave Campo and my colleague Gene Fisher. I'll see you on a Tuesday.